WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During this last week of the summer season, we're featuring a retrospective of some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. On today's Fresh Air, Gary Gilmore's youngest brother investigates his family history. Gary Gilmore killed two innocent men and in 1977 became the first criminal in over a decade to be executed in America. Michael Gilmore wanted to understand his family's violent streak and how he managed to survive the family's bad legacy. His memoir, Shot in the Heart, fills in the story Norman Mailer told in the Executioner song. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Melinda Pencava. In about 2.5 hours, the Irish Republican Army's ceasefire is to take hold in Northern Ireland. The IRA's announcement this morning was greeted with cheers in Catholic areas of Belfast and scorn among extremist Protestant groups in the British province. Gerry Adams, leader of the IRA's political wing Sinn Féin, told a crowd in Ulster today that while the IRA's 25-year-old campaign of violence was over, the struggle for a united Irish Republic would carry on. Adams called on Britain to free prisoners and withdraw its troops. British Prime Minister John Major says he is encouraged by the IRA move, but wants assurances that the ceasefire is permanent. Labor Secretary Robert Reich warned today of a splintering of the middle class. He said in Washington that America is becoming more unequal and divided along class lines. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Secretary Reich said the traditional middle class has split in three. An underclass of people without jobs, an overclass of highly skilled workers, and an anxious class of people with jobs but no job security. Reich said technological changes lie behind these divisions.
As increasingly capable machines join ever more Americans at the workplace, join them both as co-workers, but also join them as competitors, the payoff to education and to skill training has soared. And the penalty for lacking skills has stiffened.
Reich said unions should bargain for more training in their contracts. He criticized businesses for investing most of their training dollars in white, college-educated men. Reich called for a partnership to create what he called a new middle class. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Japan's Prime Minister Tomichi Miyama says Japan is creating a fund to help countries that suffered Japanese aggression during World War II. But the plan does not deal with demands for compensation from women who were forced to work in Japanese military brothels during the war. Jonathan Birchall reports.
Prime Minister Miyama said his new Peace, Friendship and Exchange Initiative is aimed at preparing for the future by overcoming the pain felt in neighboring countries over Japan's wartime record. It was, however, immediately rejected by some of those directly affected. In the Philippines, groups representing women forced to work as sex slaves for the Japanese said it didn't address their demands for direct personal compensation. The proposal is likely to get a similar response in Korea. But the move is still likely to be welcomed by Japan's allies in the region. Tokyo argues that reparations paid after 1945 mean it has already paid compensation for wartime losses.
The BBC's Jonathan Birchall reporting. Stock prices closed mixed today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average falling 4 points to close at 3913.42. On the broader market, advances led declines by a small margin in heavy trading of 354 million shares. This is NPR News. A federal court of appeals today upheld an order that gay sailor Keith Meinhold be reinstated. At issue was whether saying one is gay is the same as saying one engages in the homosexual acts that lead to being kicked out of the military. The Court of Appeals in San Francisco ruled that the military cannot bar homosexuals just because they say they are gay. Some students at the University of Wisconsin are outraged by a new policy designed to prevent rowdy behavior at Badger football games. The university just announced that security personnel will frisk all students before they enter the stadium. Steve Busalaki of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The frisking policy is in direct response to a student stampede after a big game last October in which dozens of people were hurt. To prevent similar incidents, officers will frisk students for alcohol containers or any objects they might throw. A student government leader at UW-Madison, Shira Diner, says university officials told her the frisking would be thorough enough to find marshmallows, which students commonly toss around during games. Diner calls the new policy horrible and discriminatory.
Students don't deserve to be treated like criminals and to be frisked when they walk into a football game just for the sole reason that they're students.
Students are meeting to devise a strategy for fighting the policy, but Diner says the university has no intention of changing it. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Busalaki in Madison, Wisconsin.
The judge in the O.J. Simpson case today ruled that the defense could not see the personnel records of officers involved in the double murder investigation. Simpson's attorneys asked to see the files to bolster their claim that at least one of the officers was a racist. The judge told them that he saw the records and they were not relevant. In other developments, the prosecution at today's hearing has asked that the jury be sequestered. It also said investigators have found more blood on Simpson's Ford Bronco. I'm Melinda Pencava, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we continue our week-long retrospective featuring some of our favorite interviews from the recent past. Michael Gilmore is the brother of one of America's most notorious murderers, Gary Gilmore. In July 1976, Gary Gilmore murdered two young Mormon men. He was found guilty shortly after the death penalty was restored. Insisting that he wanted to die, Gilmore refused to appeal his death sentence. In 1977, he became the first criminal to be executed in over a decade in America. Gilmore's story was told in Norman Mailer's book, The Executioner's Song, and in the film adaptation. Gary Gilmore's youngest brother, Michael, refused to be interviewed for the book. After years of trying to distance himself from his family, Michael recently became obsessed with investigating his family history. I spoke with Michael Gilmore in May after the publication of his family memoir, Shot in the Heart. Michael Gilmore has also written about pop music for Rolling Stone and other magazines. Michael was the youngest of four sons. He was 10 years younger than Gary. Michael says the family had changed so much by the time he was born. It's as if he grew up in a different family than his brothers did.
Well, I know that that my brothers grew up in a different time, a different culture, and with a very different experience. My father was something of a vagabond man. He was a man with a hidden and at least partly criminal past, and he was a man who was basically always on the run. My mother was a woman who came from a strong and stern religious background. They spent the better part of a decade basically in flight across America, moving from one state to another, one town to another, one county to another, and towing my brothers along. My brothers, you know, for 10, 11 years, possibly longer, had no sense of a real home that ever lasted literally for more than, say, 6 weeks or 2 months.
Your father's occupation when your brothers were young was basically being a scam artist.
Well, yeah. Early in his life, he'd been a clown, a tightrope walker, a lion trainer. He had been a stuntman in silent movies. I guess he had been a mayor of a small southern town for a while. He'd had many careers. He'd even been a stockbroker on Wall Street right before the crash. And then he went off into a period where he became sort of a salesman, but by and large, the stuff he sold, he would sell ads and they would never materialize. The publications would never materialize. He would take the money and move on and cart my mother and brothers along and change his name and identity in the next place, because he was always sort of in flight from his various scams.
I think another big difference, you see, your father had a legitimate business when you were growing up, so that was one big difference. He was more stable. You lived in one place for a long time. Mm-hmm. You had the same name for a long time.
But the greatest difference between my brother's experience of the family and my experience of the family was that my brothers were brutalized and witnessed brutality on an almost daily basis for at least 10 years. I did not. I never once saw my parents strike each other. I did see my father hit my brothers a few times, and I have an indelible memory of that. But I was not hit by my father except on one occasion. But my brothers, Frank and Gary and Galen, were beaten savagely with razor straps, with fists, hard objects, and they were cut and bruised and lacerated. And this was not something that happened once or twice a year. This was something that happened two or three times a week and at great length for years and years.
What change do you think in your father that explains why he beat your brothers so much, but when you were born, he beat you only once?
It's a very good question. I mean, I've tried to answer that question a lot. It is, of course, one of the central mysteries about my father for me, and I can only sort of imagine it. I don't think I have a full answer. I think that in part, I think my father saw in my older brothers, in particular in Gary, I think he saw something that reminded him of himself, and it was something he was afraid of. It was a kind of defiance, an incorrigibility that he wanted to beat down, that he wanted to defeat. I think in Gary, he simply wanted to kill it before it spread too far. I think that for whatever reason, after I was born, I think my father recognized me as his last chance at real love. It was certainly his last chance at a child, and I think that, for reasons I don't completely understand, I think that that my birth and a young childhood brought out a kind of a tenderness in him that nothing else had brought out in him before. And I had several witnesses to this, including my brothers Frank and Gary and my mother, all of whom said at several points that my father didn't seem to love anybody, but he did love me, and that they all seemed to sort of respect him for that, though I also suspected that couldn't help but probably resent him for that as well.
Maybe they resented you for that too. What was so special about you that he didn't beat you, that he loved you?
Right, of course, yes. And I believe I was aware of that in many ways as a child even. I can remember an occasion that I discuss in the book where I'd had some kind of childish argument with my brother Galen, who was 6 years older than me. I was probably about 4 or 5 at the time. Galen was probably about 10 or 11, and it had to do with plastic guns or something like that. And I wanted one of Galen's toy guns, and he wouldn't let me play with it. And my father took the gun from Galen, gave it to me, and in doing so made it clear that Galen would never have that gun again. The next day after my father left town to go to work, Galen took the guns out into the side yard, broke them, burned them, chopped them up with an axe, and then came in and told me, he said, you just wait, someday he will hate you too. And he was crying when he said it, and I can remember feeling then, I didn't articulate to myself clearly, but I think on some level I sensed that I almost felt like I deserved that moment. I didn't, there were many things I blamed Galen for and hated him for, but I thought in that moment that that I almost deserved it. I felt a kind of guilt for being a favored son at that point.
Your mother was from a strict Mormon background. And when she married your father, she found out that your father's mother was a spiritualist. She held seances. And in fact, your grandmother said that your father's real father was actually Houdini, although Houdini would never admit that. And you grew up hearing stories about this kind of royal lineage that you were descended from, the famous Houdini, and everybody in the family, especially your father, felt deprived of their rightful legacy.
Yeah, I know my father felt deprived of the legacy. Frank, my brother Frank, told me stories about how my father would get drunk with his mother, Faye, and they would sit and have long tirades against Houdini and what a terrible man he was and how he had cheated them from something. And it's true that it was sort of the myth, the legacy that we all grew up with. I remember that Galen, starting about the age of 14, Galen had a little ritual where every Halloween he would get dead drunk and light candles and try to raise Houdini's spirit. My brother Frank went on to become a professional magician, largely because of his inspiration from Houdini. The irony, I mean, this was a family myth. We all grew up hearing it, and I think to some degree believing it. When I set out to do this book, part of what I wanted to do was examine the family myths and try to see which ones stood and which ones did not stand. And the Houdini one, as much as anything, was something I really tried to pursue and to find the truth about, and I followed it for a long time. I did a lot more research than ever, of course, made it onto the page. In the end, I finally had to determine that it was simply that it was a fabricated myth. I don't think that Houdini was my father's father. I don't think he was my grandfather or my brother's grandfather. I think that it was an invention of Faye, my father's mother. For reasons that I can only guess at, but I think that it gave my father a sense always of being an abandoned and worthless child, and I think in many ways that was a sense that he in turn gave to his own sons.
My guest is writer Michael Gilmore, Gary Gilmore's youngest brother. Michael has written a family history called Shot in the Heart. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Gilmore is my guest, and he's written basically an investigation into his family history. It's called Shot in the Heart. And his brother was Gary Gilmore, who was executed for killing two men. Now, a lot of your book, you're not even in, because it's the family history before you were born.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you didn't meet your brother, Gary, until you were 3 or 4 years old, because he was in reform school.
Yes.
When you were born, what do you have memories of that first time you met him and what your impressions of him were?
My mother tells me that when I was a child, Gary used to play with me and that he paid a special attention to me, that he would hold me on his lap and that he would take me places. I have no recollection of that. I don't have the kind of vivid, strong memory of early childhood that, that other people in my family, particularly Frank, had. My first memory of Gary was from a time when I would have been, I think, about 4 or 5. And I had been out in the front yard of our home in Portland, Oregon, playing on a hot summer day, I think, or a hot fall day, and went into the house to get a drink of water. And I saw my mother and brother sitting at the kitchen table, and I saw among them a perfect stranger, a young man about 14, 15 with short hair and wearing sort of a khaki shirt and khaki pants. And I said, "Who's that?" And my mother said, "Well, that's your brother Gary." And everybody at the table laughed because obviously I should have known. But I think it was probably apparent that I had no idea what they were talking about. And my mother said, "Well, we've kept him buried out back for a while, and we've just decided to dig him up." But the truth was he'd been in reform school, and he'd been in reform school for a year and a half or 2 years, and more or less had left the home even well before that. He was somebody who began to leave the home when he was around 11 or 12 and spent as much time away as he could. So he was not somebody that I had a childhood memory of. He was not somebody that I can say truthfully that I did not grow up with Gary. Gary was a presence, an intrusion that would come in and out of our lives. He was somebody I loved powerfully and was attracted to and wanted to know, but also feared and sensed as a dangerous person. And when he came, the world around us changed, and usually in very stormy and destructive ways.
How would your world change when Gary would come back home?
Well, the first thing that would happen is that the fights between my mother and father would get even worse. My father was deeply angry with Gary and the way he was messing up his life. My mother, I think, felt deep pain for what's happening to Gary and felt that he was probably not to blame for anything that was going wrong. So they would fight over Gary's responsibility or their responsibility for him. And the fights were bitter and painful because the fight became another way for them to hurt each other, in particular for my father to hurt my mother. I think by attacking Gary so much and banning Gary from the house and punishing Gary and declaring Gary an unworthy person over and over and over, I think that was one of the most effective tools my father found to hurt my mother, because it was a rejection of the son that she loved most and wanted to protect the most, and I think it made her feel helpless. I think she almost felt in those times as if there was something like a death sentence being passed on Gary out of my father's mouth. And I really do think in many ways that's where she gained her great fear for what would come of Gary, because she saw him rejected and sentenced in some ways early on by my father.
Did Gary scare you? Did you admire him? Did his criminal acts frighten you or attract you in some way?
Gary intrigued me. His criminal acts never attracted me. Nobody's criminal acts have ever attracted me. Gary's, I always saw that as a wasteful and heartbreaking side of Gary's character. Gary was an extremely smart and talented man. He was articulate. He was on his own a well-educated and well-versed and well-read person, and he and his great talent was as an artist. He could draw terrifically. He never had much interest and never placed much value in those talents. And I can remember, as a young person, being just being sort of dumbfounded by that. Many times I tried to get Gary to show me how to draw or to draw something for me, and he never had any interest in it. I think art worked on an entirely different level for him. But it did not work on any level where it gave him a sense of purpose or pride. Gary was somebody I was strongly curious about and very attracted to. Of all my brothers, he was the one I wanted to know the most and be the closest to. He was probably the one I wanted most to hold me close to him and to teach me things. But there was a 10 years difference between us. He didn't have much time or appetite for having a brother that little.
One piece of advice he once gave you was, if someone wants to beat you, the only way to survive is to let them. You have to learn to take things mm-hmm. and feel nothing.
Mm-hmm.
What did that advice mean to you?
What I thought he was saying to me was that people would hurt you in this world, and the best way to survive it was to let them hurt you and not fight back, because if you fought back, they would hurt you more. I learned later that this was a piece of advice that actually he had picked up by example from my brother Frank. When my father used to beat Frank and he used to beat Gary, he would use often a belt and a buckle, and it would cut them and bruise them. And Frank told me that he learned early on that if he was stoic about it, if he acted as if it were not hurting him, and if he were quiet and just held it in, then my father would lose interest in beating Frank and would stop after a minute or two. But Gary could never do that. Gary could never withstand the outrage and the unfairness of it, and he would cry and scream, and he would beg for my father to stop. And Frank remembers that that would only incite my father to worse beatings. He would really wail on Gary until Gary was basically insensible. And I think that the advice that Gary gave me that at that point was the advice that he could never really take for himself. I think that he was looking for a better way to deal with all the pain that he'd had to accept for so long.
Before your brother Gary Gilmore was executed, he told your uncle that the first person he wanted to murder was his father.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if I could have killed him and gotten away with it, I would have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he hated him that much?
I do. Gary told my uncle that on the last day of his life, and among the last hours of his life, he said that, I think somebody asked him at some point if he'd ever killed somebody before, if he'd ever wanted to, and he said the first person he wanted to kill was my father, and he'd wanted to do it since he was a child. I think he did hate him that much. What's interesting is that in that same conversation, he also declared a lot of love and admiration for my father. He thought my father was in many ways a strong and remarkable man. The contradiction of that is also the truth of his feeling for the man. I think my father was somebody he wanted to have a closeness to, and he certainly wanted to enjoy my father's acceptance. And he never really received that. And of course, that would cause him to feel resentment and hatred and even violence. But I remember also in the last couple weeks of my father's life, I remember Gary coming to see my father in Seattle in 1962 when my father was dying of cancer, and he wanted some kind of last reconciliation with my father. And they'd had a fight a short while before, and my father was still holding the grudge and wasn't going to let go. And they weren't able to do it, and I can remember that Gary just looked very pained when he walked out. I think Gary knew certainly that my father did not have much longer to live, and I think he knew that this was the last chance for any kind of real love to pass between them. I think Gary always hated my father, and I think he always longed for him, and I think Gary loved my father Gary hated my father with the kind of hatred that comes from having loved somebody who did not love you in return.
You wrote that the Gary you remember best from childhood was when he was about 21, right after he came out of the Oregon State Correctional Institution,
mm-hmm.
and he'd become really hardened. How had he changed?
Well, he was a much, much colder man. He was a much deadlier man at that point. I think he was also somebody who was much more given to using drugs. I certainly, looking back at it now, it's quite plain to me that he was using various kinds of drugs, probably codeine cough syrup and maybe some... Maybe some opiates or barbiturates, but that was part of what I saw in him, a man who slurred much more and seemed drunk but not really drunk. And of course, at that age, I didn't really know what drugs were or what they were about. I also saw in him a kind of recklessness and a kind of abandon, as if he was willing to risk or do anything. That nothing would daunt him, nothing would frighten him, and I think that was the point at which I began to see him as a deadly man. I know that from an early age, and probably from this period, I gained a sense that Gary was somebody who could kill somebody. That Gary was a dangerous person, and that there was a part of him that was almost looking for that moment or that opportunity in his life.
Did you or anyone in your family try to control him as he appeared to be increasingly dangerous?
Well, I certainly didn't. I was a child. I was somebody who was 10 or 11 when I saw Gary at those times. I know that my brother Frank certainly tried to have some good talks with Gary, but I think Gary would just mollify Frank and pretend that he was taking the advice and go on his own. My father was dead by that point. My mother, sir, had a philosophy that you should not prevail on your children. You should be there for them, but you shouldn't try to impose your will on them, because it would only make things worse. But in truth, nobody really had to try to do much of that for Gary because Gary was a very inept criminal. Virtually every time he committed a crime, he got caught. And nearly every time he got caught, he got thrown in jail, whether it was just for a weekend or eventually for 15 years. He spent most of his time in his life in jail. From the time he was 14 until his death, Gary spent almost 20 years in jail.
You found out about Gary's two murders in the newspaper.
Yeah, so when I was living in Portland.
What went through your mind when you saw the headline?
Well, it was I think it was a page two or page three item on a Saturday night in the local newspaper, the Oregonian. I'd come home from work, I sat and I was just thumbing through the paper. I saw an item that said, "Oregon man held in Utah slayings," and that's all I had to see. I knew right then what it was, and certainly within the first sentence that was confirmed, it said that my brother had been arrested for two murders on consecutive nights in Provo, and I felt stunned. I know I felt nauseous. I know I did, in fact, throw up, and I felt certainly at that time, at that moment, that my life had changed irrevocably, that there was no way I could ever get past, or at least no way I could ever deny or forget that moment. And I also had a sense that that it had been a long time coming, and even though I was stunned, I was not shocked or surprised. I think I felt that that there was something about this that had been inevitable.
Michael Gilmore's family memoir is called Shot in the Heart. Our interview was recorded in May. The interview continues in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the execution of Gary Gilmore. We continue our conversation with Gilmore's youngest brother, Michael. Gary Gilmore refused to appeal his death sentence. He said he wanted to die. Michael opposes the death penalty and wanted his brother to live, yet Michael decided not to seek a stay of execution. Michael will tell us about the conversations he had with his brother while Gary was on death row. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Deputy Irish Foreign Minister is going to visit President Clinton at his vacation retreat on Martha's Vineyard this Friday. They'll talk about the Irish Republican Army's ceasefire and the Irish peace process. The IRA truce takes effect at midnight local time. Both the British and the Irish governments insist the end of violence must be the first step before they'll talk to the IRA. NPR's Michael Goldfarb says the truce is a major step toward that goal.
This moves the peace process forward. There's no doubt that the Irish government feels that this ceasefire, the form it's taking, is sufficient to move the peace process forward. They're planning a general conference later in the autumn. And if after 90 days the ceasefire still holds, then according to the terms of the Downing Street Declaration made by the two prime ministers last December, then Sinn Féin will be invited into multi-party constitutional talks on the future of Northern Ireland.
The United States is also denying a report from Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds. The premier says that Washington is going to come up with a multi-million dollar aid package for Ireland. The White House says no such package has been created, although financial aid could be an option. The United States is again warning the Haitian junta to get out of the country. Senior administration officials are telling the military leaders they face capture if there's an invasion, and they would be turned over to the control of a new Haitian government. Reuters News Service is quoting the U.S. officials who say a possible invading force would also be very large as to minimize any possible casualties. Egypt's foreign minister, who's visiting Jerusalem, says Israel must withdraw from the Golan Heights if it wants peace with Syria. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Foreign Minister Amr Moussa is in Israel for the highest-profile visit by an Egyptian leader in years. Israeli officials say it's part of a conscious decision by Egypt to deepen ties with Israel. Moussa said the only possible peace deal between Israel and Syria is full peace in exchange for a full withdrawal from the Golan Heights. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said that he did not have a mandate to withdraw from the Golan and would hold a national referendum before any significant withdrawal. Moussa also asked Israel to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, but Israel has never admitted it has nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Germany today opens an intersection in the autonomous Palestinian enclave of Jericho. It's the first foreign intersection in the autonomous areas. I'm Linda Gradstein reporting.
Philip Morris Company has raised its shareholder dividend by 20% today. The company says it will spend $6 billion to buy back its own stock over the next 3 years. These moves come as the company comes under growing pressure to boost the value of its holdings. The board has already decided not to divide the company into separate food and tobacco businesses. On Wall Street, the Dow was down almost 4 points at 39.13. This is NPR. A federal appeals court has upheld an order reinstating a gay sailor into the Navy. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has backed the order returning Keith Meinhold to service, but it has overturned a district judge's sweeping ban on discrimination against homosexuals in the U.S. military. The appeals court says a service member cannot be discharged from the service simply because he or she has announced their homosexuality without any intent to act upon it. Hopes for ending the baseball strike are growing dim. The walkout is now in its third week, but the baseball strike is just one of several labor disputes in the sports world. NPR's Mark Schramm prepared this report.
Today in New York, federal mediators are meeting separately with representatives of baseball owners and players to try to restart negotiations, which broke off last week. A proposed salary cap for players remains the intractable issue. A salary cap is the sticking point in talks between National Hockey League players and owners as well. The owners want a revamped salary system in a new collective bargaining agreement. The players say that amounts to a cap, and they don't want it. Hockey training camps are supposed to open this weekend, but the owners may lock the players out if no progress towards an agreement is made. And National Football League owners and on-field officials resume contract talks today in Chicago. The referees say they want pay equity with officials in other sports, or they'll go on strike October 9th. I'm Mark Schramm reporting.
United Nations officials say there are terrible new signs of retaliation killings in Rwanda. A spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees says the killings are in eastern Rwanda, where thousands of Hutu refugees are fleeing to Tanzania. A spokesman says a few bodies are being found every day in a river between the two countries. They've generally been shot or stabbed. It's not clear who's murdering the victims, but the UN speculates that Tutsis, who now control the Rwandan government, might be taking revenge. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Gilmore. He's the youngest brother of Gary Gilmore, who was executed in 1977 for killing two men. For many years, Michael dealt with the pain of his family legacy by distancing himself from his remaining family. But he spent the past few years investigating his family's past, trying to comprehend the family's violent streak. Michael Gilmore's new book is called Shot in the Heart. Your brother, Gary Gilmore, wanted to be executed. He didn't want a stay of execution. He didn't want people to work on his behalf. to prevent his execution. But you oppose the death penalty, and you wanted to see your brother live. So you had some conversations with him about this. What were those conversations like?
Well, they were never easy conversations. I mean, it became quite apparent to Gary, the first conversation or two we had on the subject, that I was opposed to his execution, and I was actively opposed. I might seek a stay. And we had conversations on the phone before I went to Utah along those lines, and those conversations always ended up with us slamming the phone on each other or yelling at each other. You know, he told me, point blank to butt out, and I told him that I thought that that he wasn't the only person with rights that should be heeded in this matter. In Utah, surprisingly, our conversation did not reach that kind of fever pitch except for a couple of moments. I knew that if I was going to do anything to try to stop Gary's execution, I had to talk to him face to face. I felt like I owed that to him. I felt like I had a strong suspicion that there was really no way to save Gary's life, that you might be able to seek a stay that could put the execution off for a while, but that he was a man who was going to die, that he was determined to die, and he would take his own life, and he had attempted to take his own life. And I felt that to do that at that point, to actually seek and effect a stay, could be something that could have real damaging consequences, for his heart and his soul. I think he'd worked up his courage and whatever sense of moral belief he had that this was the appropriate and right thing to do. And I think once he recognized that I was not there simply just to impose my will on him, but to try to talk with him, to try to reason with him, I think it opened up a kind of discourse that had never happened between us before.
So you gave up on trying to save him? You thought that would have been the wrong thing to do?
I don't think I thought it would have been a wrong thing to do. I don't think there was a right or a wrong thing to do. I felt like I was stuck in the worst place you could get stuck in your life, that any choice you made could have mortal consequences and that there was simply no right choice.
During one of your conversations with your brother Gary Gilmore while he was in prison, he basically confessed to you that there was a point when he might have killed you.
Yes, he did, and I can't say that surprised me. I think when I said earlier that I had sensed that Gary was a deadly man, I think I sensed that he could be a deadly man to me or to anybody else in our family. I'd seen him get in violent confrontations with my father where I thought that he was indeed going to kill my father. I think that Gary's full of, by the end of his life, and particularly by the end of his life at the point where he committed the murders, Gary was full of deep hatred and resentment for anybody who'd had the life he didn't have, a life of family, a life of children, a life that allowed for a future. I was the only person who really had managed in some ways to escape the family, to have anything resembling an education or a career. And I think that And the only one to have enjoyed my father's love. I think that a lot of that resentment could have caught up at the end. I think if Gary and I had been alone, if Gary had come to me, especially after committing the kind of crimes if he'd come to me seeking a favor from me or seeking protection from me, I would have refused him. I would not have taken Gary in. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. Some people would say that's a good and moral thing. I'm not sure it is, but I know that I would not have. I know that I would have been so angry, so repulsed over what he had done that I would not have let him into my home.
And in fact, he was coming, I think, to Portland in the hopes that you would give him shelter when he was running from the law.
He was on his way to Portland. He was trying to go to Portland when he was arrested. He was on his way to the airport outside of Provo so that he could in fact come to Portland. It was a desperate last-ditch attempt. There's no way he was going to get out of Utah at that point. But I think in his mind, that was the next stop. Next stop was Portland, and I think the next stop would have been more killing.
And you think if he came to stay with you and you didn't put him up, he would have killed you?
Yes, I do.
Basically what he told you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he was capable of it. I don't think he was proud of it, but I think he felt that there simply would have been no choice under those circumstances, that he would not have abided that kind of rejection.
What was your reaction to your brother's choice of firing squad as the way to die?
Well, my reaction was that it was likely, given his flair for bravado and his image of himself as a, you know, as a brave man. Mm-hmm. It also made to me it made sense given the legacy that we had grown up with. We had grown up in my home. We had grown up hearing from my mother about the specter of capital punishment in Utah and what a horrible thing it was, and what a barbaric thing it was. How it was a state that still exercised the death penalty through firing squads and through hanging, and that in particular the use of the firing squad was something that had been derived from the doctrine of the Mormon Church and their long history in Utah. The Mormons had a belief in something they called the doctrine of blood atonement, and it's a complicated matter, and they have their own explanation of it. But basically, the idea is that there are certain sins that can only be paid for through blood, and through the spilling of blood. And they don't mean just a little blood; they mean all the blood that you have. And certainly, one of those sins is the taking of another life. And it is not just enough to lay down your life, or to die in an electric chair, or to die by hanging. It only suffices if you allow your blood to be spilled. In a sense, it made a kind of made a sad and horrible sense when Gary chose that as the way for him to die. It was almost as if it was something that had been coming down the road for a long time.
My guest is Michael Gilmore, Gary Gilmore's youngest brother. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Michael Gilmore is my guest, and his new book, Shot in the Heart, is about his brother Gary Gilmore and about his whole family. Do you feel that in order to try to distance yourself from what you've described as the family curse, that you had to leave your family?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I felt that long before I ever left. I felt that as a child. I knew I would leave them. I couldn't wait to leave them. And I thought I had done it successfully more than once, and then I realized more than once that wherever you go, you carry things that are just so essential to you that are formed out of your history and out of your family memory.
Michael, I'd like to ask you to read a short passage from your book, from your memoir, Shot in the Heart.
Okay.
This has to deal with families.
Okay. God, I hate families. I see them walking in their clean clusters in a shopping mall, or I hear friends talking about family get-togethers and family problems, or I visit families in their homes, and I inevitably resent them. I resent them for whatever real happiness they may have achieved, and because I didn't have such a family in my life. And I despise them for the ways in which the notion of the family good is still used to shame or subjugate the children within the family, long past the time when they've become adults. But perhaps I'm protesting too much here. The truth is, I do not judge my parents harshly at all. I do not feel an ounce of hatred or bitterness toward either of them, though maybe I should. I love my parents. These days, I miss them both terribly. But there is something ironic that I have had to recognize about my act of contemplating my own family. In a better world, I would not be telling this story because this story would never have happened. In a better world, my parents would not have met, or at least they would not have married and had a family. In a better world, I would never have been born. What sad and wretched people Frank Gilmore and Bessie Brown were. I love them, but I have to say, it is heartrending they ever had children at all.
You write that you hate families. Do you want to have children of your own one day, or are you afraid of this, like, mystery in the blood that you'd be passing on?
I've always wanted to have children, and I like children. I don't know if it will happen in my life for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I'm now 43 years old. My father was an old man when he started to have children. I know that mid-40s may not seem like an old man, But it's at the same time, you know, if I had a child now, when that child was 20, I'd be in my mid-60s and probably would not be around that much longer. One of the things I did consciously resent my father for was leaving me when I was young, dying when I was young, not being able to have him later. I think that's as much something to be afraid of as anything. I don't think that necessarily, I certainly don't think these things are passed along in any genetic way. I think that they can be passed along in unconscious ways. I would hope that I've learned enough about the unconscious reality of my family's history that if I have children, I will be careful not to pass those things along. But I think it's also true that in having children, you can learn things about yourself that you never knew before, and you may learn things you may not be able to control. And I think that was what happened with my father when he had children. I think he learned that there was a part of those children he wanted to kill, that he wanted to destroy, that he wanted to beat down. And if I have children, I may find something very different. I certainly hope so. I guess I would think this is the longest preparatory course I can imagine.
What happened to your other two older brothers, to Galen and to Frank?
Well, my Galen died in the early 70s. He had moved to Chicago and been there for several years, started a love affair with a woman, and he got attacked at some point. Circumstances have never been plain to me, though. What happened is quite plain. He was stabbed repeatedly, probably with an ice pick in his abdomen. And the wounds were so deep and severe that they never really healed. Plus, he kept drinking, which didn't help it. It took a few years, but the combination of the unhealed wounds and the untempered alcoholism killed him. My brother Frank, who was 11 years older than I am and 1 year older than Gary, I lost track of Frank after my mother died in the early 1980s. But I certainly realized when I decided that I was going to try to tell the story that I had to find him, if only to let him know that it was only the fair thing to do, and also to let him, if he wanted to or was willing to, participate in the recollection of the story. Initially, he was quite reluctant to do it, but after some thought on his own and certainly with no pressure from me, he decided that he did want to help me tell the story, and I think that by far the most valuable contribution I got from anybody or anything in this book was the contribution of Frank's memory and his storytelling. And I also think that the most valuable thing I emerged from this book was a new and deeper relationship with my brother, a relationship I probably could not have had otherwise.
You know, you wrote this book in the hopes of understanding something of the family mystery, of why the family turned out the way it did. Do you feel like you're any closer to understanding that now?
I am closer. There's so much that I didn't get. There were many things I didn't get. There were many paths in my father's past that he just kept covered very well that I was not able to uncover and probably never will be able to uncover. And certainly this is a story you tell once. I will never write another book about my family, that's for sure. I uncovered as much as I think I could within the boundaries that I had to work. I would have given anything to have learned a lot more about who my father really was and what his past really was and what his secrets were and what his fears were and what his crimes were. I still think that there's a heart of the story that is there and that eluded me, but my father was adept at eluding people, and I think I did as good a job as could be done in the circumstances.
Are people still a little bit afraid of you, suspicious of you, when they find out that your brother was Gary Gilmore?
Well, it's funny. It actually does still happen. There are also the people, of course, who are attracted to you for that reason, which makes me at least as uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But there will still be occasions when I'll meet somebody, and for whatever reason, it becomes plain that I was related to Gary, and I can sense them tense up or withdraw. It's not the way I introduce myself to people, but it's sometimes the way other people have made introductions.
Of course, now people will know more that it's you because of the book.
Yes, and that was, believe me, that was a big deterrent for a long time to the idea of ever writing a book like this. I did not want to be known simply as Gary's brother. I did not want to have that the prime association in my life. And as I say, that was a great deterrent. I had to think about that long and hard. From the time I first seriously considered this to the time that I actually got around to writing a proposal, 9 or 10 months lapsed. And lapsed because of consideration of that question, did I really want to put myself that much out on the line as being related to such an unpleasant story?
My guest is Michael Gilmore, Gary Gilmore's youngest brother. He's written a new book about his family called Shot in the Heart. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the IRA's declaration of a ceasefire?
Hi, Terry. Several things. Neil Conan takes us back a few years, giving us the history of the struggle in Northern Ireland. Michael Goldfarb reports on details of the arrangement from Belfast. Also, Irish-American reaction from Boston. In other stories, Patricia Naiman has a report on the efforts of past administrations in Washington to improve the quality of health care in America. UN Care has another history story about the Hinckley Fire in Minnesota one century ago. And from Miami, Cuban Americans talk about trying to keep track of relatives they believe to be coming across the water from Cuba.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Michael Gilmore, Gary Gilmore's youngest brother. Gary was executed by a firing squad in 1977 for killing two men. Your brother became one of those, you know, excuse the expression, celebrity killers, you know, while he was on death row. And the whole press was there covering it and watching it and commenting about it. And I can just imagine how uncomfortable it was to be in the spotlight for that reason. And the whole, you know, the whole family was in the spotlight for this. You're a journalist yourself, mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in hearing what it was like for you to watch the press and the tabloid press cover your brother's story.
Well, it was horrible. I mean, the horror started when I first read the item in the newspaper about Gary committing the murders. That was where it began, and I felt like that was something I would have to live with, and I felt like that was something that upended my world. Later, when Gary decided that he wanted to indeed die in front of a firing squad, that he wanted his execution, he insisted his execution be carried out, the horror, at least doubled or tripled. I mean, overnight, Gary was a man of front-page notoriety. Overnight, my family's history was a matter of public scrutiny. Overnight, our pictures and our secrets were being covered in news weeklies and tabloid newspapers. And it was a kind of vertigo to find, You wake up every day and you turn on the TV and the darkest parts of your family and your heart are public. And there's nothing you can do except not participate in it, which I certainly chose to do. And in fact, I was at that time a journalist, a young journalist. I was learning things about journalism. I was just starting to write for Rolling Stone magazine when all this happened. And if there's one semi-beneficial thing that came from that whole period and from that time was it was a kind of education, a reverse education in journalism. And I came out of that with a hope and a commitment that I would not practice that kind of journalism as much as possible. I'm sure I have failed that standard many times. And I may have failed it in a different direction. I probably have not been as aggressive or as pushy as I should have been at times as a journalist, because there's certain kinds of questions that I was not comfortable asking as a result of the experience I had. And that, too, can be a failure. But it's, as I have said before, it's a failure that I'm willing to live with.
Did you have much of a physical likeness to your brother?
A little. I always thought that Gary and Galen and myself looked a bit like my mother, and that Frank never looked anything like us. And then later, when I realized that Frank probably had a different father, that made sense.
So if you looked a little bit like Gary, would you look at him and wonder if you could see yourself in him?
At times I certainly did. When Gary was about 14 and I was about 14, we looked identical in that. And I've looked at those pictures many times and just been sort of stunned by that. And wondered if in fact we were the same person at those points, if we had like similar fears and similar dreams and hopes, and tried to wonder where his went and where mine went and how they went off into different paths. I certainly see, you know, some common things in temperament or intelligence or that sort of thing, but there's so many other things we don't share.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Gilmore recorded last May. His family memoir is called Shot in the Heart. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our week-long retrospective is produced by Roberta Schirach. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Dan Lachlan. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.